I like the arts, and I was trying to think of what the appropriate theatrical analogy might be for Dr. Stinson this morning. One of those grand operas where everybody dies at the end or something.
Question is whether he is dead already.
I'm thinking about leaving if that's the way this is going to end.
Think how lucky you
It's a metaphor, I think. Well, anyway, this morning we'd like to have a discussion with Commissioner Hansen, Dr. Stinson, Mr. Showalter about the forecast, what trends we see and what to expect possibly. Obviously, with the committee is senior members, most of us were probably at the briefing, but this will give us an opportunity to talk in a little bit more detail about what where we're going. So I'm not sure, I'll start. Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. I think the appropriate analogy for Dr. Stinson is the screamer in that Van Gogh.
The screamer.
That was Munch, but that's okay.
What?
Edward Munch.
Actually, it's probably Waiting for Godot.
Oh, and that happy note.
I like King that. Lear.
If you turn to the first slide, the story of the, as you heard a few days ago, and you'll hear again at the hearing, the economy has significantly worsened yet again from the last forecast, and Dr. Stinson will talk about that in a moment. The good news, of course, in the forecast is that deterioration in the economy, that lessening of revenues we're seeing, has been more than made up by the MA stimulus money that we recognize in this forecast. And Jim Showalter, our state budget director, will talk about that. But if you look at the first slide, the actual number, the technical number is 4.57. But when you factor in the 1.8, or if you take that away, it would have been almost $6.4 billion, and I think that's an important point. How did we get that? If you turn to the next page, you can see some of the key numbers. You see that the lower, almost 1.2 in lower revenues, that's a fairly significant drop from a November to a February forecast. As is usual in a February forecast, we don't see much variation in spending. That 152 is just a minor uptick. And the we book 1.3 of the 1.8 of the stimulus in 10 and 11. And then you see the other positive thing about this, Mr. Chairman, is we have a $236 million balance in 2009, which helps us get out of the current biennium without having to take more action to balance the budget.
Commissioner, if I can ask, I hope I know what the forecast we like to hold off until everybody's finished. I don't know if you mind if there are questions as we
whatever you prefer.
Proceed. Just normally I don't do it that way, but in putting together the forecast where you do declare the federal money, now you've declared what the FMAP monies, but not the others. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I think Mr. Showalter is going to get into your question a moment. If just to finish up, you see how it was 4.8. You see the numbers that gets to 4.5. I'll turn it over to Mr. Showalter, and you'll see why he'll explain why we recognize medical assistance, but why we don't have the authority to recognize the fiscal stabilization. And he'll walk through that piece first, and then he'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. My name is Jim Showalter, for the record. I'm the State Budget Director. And I will start with the slide that's entitled Federal Stimulus Bill Provides Broad Relief to Minnesota. As the Commissioner said, this forecast has really two major components. The one which we're talking about now is the inclusion of some of the stimulus impacts on the budget. It was an issue that we had raised prior to the forecast so that the staff was aware of some of those issues, and it's something you've seen in prior forecasts, not necessarily due to a stimulus bill, but certainly the change in the FMAP rate goes back to the start of the medical assistance program. The statutory authority already assumes that there's going to be a federal share and a state share in this program. In this instance, the federal government has changed that mark, so that was included in the forecast. That changes state spending by about $1.8 billion over the 3 years. Other funds that are included in the stimulus bill are not set up for recognition under current law. The stabilization funds in particular need legislative review for receipt and expenditure. So that is where this forecast includes some of those countercyclical funds, but not all of them. As we've talked before in previous discussions, there's about $4.6 billion estimated in state and local grants that will be coming through the state or some of the local entities. That figure is listed on our website and some of the grants that we are counting within that. Much of that is not relevant to the forecast, not relevant to the budget deficit that the commissioner has been talking about so far. If you want to take a look at the next chart, it discusses the types of state stimulus funding, and that divides the major categories of stimulus funding into three major categories. The first two are blocks show the forecast impact that was included, the Medicaid match money. There's also the potential budget impact of the state stabilization funds. Those are known as the countercyclical funding for states that was included in the federal stimulus bill. The two other major groupings that we've been discussing include dedicated funding, things like highway funding, clean water projects, things like that, and then competitive grants that are also undetermined, and we'll be working through those applications and those processes in the coming weeks and months. Does that get to the I think the questions that you were raising, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners Hansen, is your department going to be the focal point of the handling of grant applications for the various categories, or will that be dispersed in some other way?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, it will be dispersed by agency and their expertise. The Commerce Department on the green jobs,
okay.
Deed also on green jobs, but health IT will be the health department. It will be based on who has the expertise and has the personnel that are used to working with grant recipients.
So, Mr. Chairman, is that information available to potential applicants now on your website, or is any format been established for, providing information on those grants and how to apply and what criteria needs to be addressed in the applications and so on?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we're still waiting to get 20 days after the passage of the bill. We're supposed to get more information on the grant programs and the criteria, and then 30 days after passage, the federal government is supposed to give us the applications.
Okay.
Right now, we have contacts on our website, but we're waiting for some of that other information. But they'll be able to go to our website and link to the others.
Thank you.
Okay. Review our Mr. Alter. Oh, Senator Tomasoni.
Just a follow up to that, Commissioner. So, am I hearing you say that the agencies will be in charge of dispersing the money, or will they come through the committee at the legislature first before it goes to the agency?
Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, the first two categories on the slide in front of you are authorized by the legislature. The competitive grants, we have the ability, the state does, or local units of government, nonprofits, to apply for. If we happen to apply for a grant and we get the federal money for it and it's state money, then we have to come to the legislature for authorization to use that, like we do all federal funds. The issue, I think ahead of time, there'll be a few circumstances where we may need to identify the match. You know, there might be a state match. I know there's, at least in the health area, there's might be a match. And we'll need to maybe identify that and have that in our budget or something. But we can't use any of the money unless we get your authorization.
So, Commissioner, in that case, at least relative to grants coming in, if it's subsequent to the session, you'd go through what the LAC process then is, as you normally do?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Yes. Senator Tomasoni?
Well, and yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I clarify, it depends on the timing. If we are able to get these grant applications together, there basically would be a typical federal funds request in conjunction with the governor's budget, so that if we can get that information to the legislature by March 28th, essentially it becomes a 20-day review. Should we not be able to get all those requests in, or should some lag behind, then they would go through the LAC process perhaps after session.
Okay. Senator Foley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Early on, we were led to believe there wouldn't be any earmarking, and now apparent that that's not true. What is that going to do to what we're getting coming into Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator, most of the funds that we're talking about here are essentially programs that the committees are already very, very well familiar, that the federal statutes have been set up, that the rules and regulations have been set up. In cases of earmarks, I'm thinking probably some of the transportation issues, those would have to be considered in the authorization and ultimately the approval of funds by the state.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, I wonder if you're thinking about the new bill that Congress is debating right now, that they might have even passed it. It's the appropriation bill. It's not the stimulus bill. It's the appropriation bill for the next year. And that's the one that has all the earmarks from last year, where there's controversy about Obama signing it, and they've said, well, that's last year's bill. We're going to move on. I just read that in the paper.
Well,
I think Senator Pappas.
I'll accept that for now.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Chair, if I may add, I'm not aware of many issues around earmarks in the stimulus bill. It depends on your definition of earmarks, where there's specific programs that are getting funding, certainly. But I think by and large, you're seeing most of these programs just getting increased funding to be handled in the way that they've been handled in the past.
Yes, thank you.
Senator Foley, there are no earmarks in this bill, but in a way the Obama administration kept the earmarks for themselves because we all have to compete.
Yeah, it was last
so
October's
just a different form of earmarking.
Mr. Showalter?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members, to take you on to the next slide in the presentation, the chart is entitled State Medical Assistance Spending. Since one of the two major stories here, one is the decrease in spending associated with the state, the stimulus bill that largely goes through the medical assistance program. A small portion goes through the Minnesota Care program. What that does is it decreases the state cost to health care. It doesn't decrease the cost of health care. It decreases the state share of that cost. What this graphic tries to articulate is how that works. The total bar, the dark and the light section, is basically the state share of the medical assistance program during the period 2008 through 2013, based upon this forecast. That is if there was no change in the matching rate. Based upon estimates from DHS, we're assuming about $1.8 billion savings for the state budget during that period of time, which is represented by those white boxes at the top. As a result, the forecast that you're looking at and the expenditures that you're looking at and the budget that you're looking at has less state costs in 2009, 10, and 11. And as the stimulus effect wears off or stops on December 31st, 2010, then the state share will pop back up to the 50%, and then the state costs will arise accordingly. Sometimes we've been talking about this as I've heard some confusion as whether is this a revenue, will we get the entire amount? This is a matching fund. This is a change in how much we get from the federal government for every dollar that we spend. So for every dollar, this is based upon the assumption of a current law forecast and the current economic conditions and our usual caveats around medical assistance spending, cost trends, all those kinds of things. If we end up spending more because more people will sign up due to economic conditions, the match number would go up. If fewer people sign up or budget proposals come in that reduce the medical assistance spending, the match amount would go down. either way, what we're looking at here is an underlying health care trend that for a couple of years we're having the federal government pick up a larger share of it.
Chairman, Mr. Showalter, on the medical assistant program, could you tell us how much of that is for long-term care, or in other words, nursing homes?
Mr. Chair, I'll get you that information in just 1 minute. I give you a ballpark, but we'll get you the right number in a second.
Mr. Showalter.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that really closes up the expenditure side of it. I will, once we're done with the economy, I'll get you the spending breakdown on medical assistance and any other questions that you may have. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson.
Okay. Dr. Stinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's no surprise the economy is weaker than we expected in November. In fact, when we were here testifying before your committee in December, we told you that it was likely that it was going to be a lot weaker, and it turns out that it is. The weaker economy has led to lower revenue forecasts for 2009 and for 2010-2011 biennium. For 2009, we are now projecting revenues to be $213 million less than we expected in November. Of that $213 million, $133 million of that reflects revenue shortfalls, negative variances, we call them, between the November forecast and actual receipts up to date. And so really what we're doing is saying that the deterioration that we saw in revenues between November and February continues at more or less the same rate. For 2010-2011, the revenues are now expected to be $1.166 billion less than we expected in November. There are two sources of that. First of all, the economy is noticeably worse than we expected. And then second, we've made some changes in our estimate of what's going to happen to capital gains realizations that had a material impact on the forecast. The income tax now is down, expected to be $701 million less than it was expected in November. That's 0.4% less than we collected in 2006-2007. So in 2010, we're going to have less in there. Sales tax is $202 million less. The corporate is $230 million less. Overall, revenues, again, are $1.166 billion less. The top of page 5, it shows you the change that we've made to capital gains receipts, expected capital gains receipts. In November, our forecast was for a 30% decline in capital gains in 2008, tax year 2008, and an additional 10% decline in tax year 2009. The combination of a noticeably weaker economy in the forecast for 2009 and the miserable performance of the stock market over the last little bit has led us to revise that capital gains forecast down noticeably. We now have a 40% decline in 2009, coming off of a 35% decline in 2008. In doing this forecast, this is a major change. It takes more than $200 million out of 2009. We talked to people at the Congressional Budget Office who had released a forecast in January for U.S. capital gains. They said that they were revising their forecast, that actually they'd pitched one of their models that they were using and were trying to come up with another model because they were more pessimistic than they had been even in their January forecast. We know that states like New York and Massachusetts have become more pessimistic as well, and so we think this is more or less in the right spot, although as you see from this graph, this is not an impossible kind of a thing that could happen, and that there is room for it to be even worse. Of course, there's also room for us to have been a little bit too pessimistic. If you look at the last couple of years on that graph, you see big declines in 2008 and 2009, then a big jump in 2010, then a big drop-off in 2011. The big jump in tax year 2010, which affects receipts in fiscal year 2011, is due to the change in federal tax rate on capital gains that is expected to expire. Under current law, in 2010, the 15% rate expires, beginning in 2011, federal tax rate on capital gains is 20%. We expect, and historically when there's been this kind of a change, what's happened is that people will logically take advantage of the lower capital gains tax rate in 2010 and accelerate some of the sales of assets from 2011-2012 into 2010. That gives us a one-time bump in revenues that's about $200 million. Then in 2011 and 12, it reduces revenues. The reason why I bring this up is that this forecast is done on current law, and that's what we think would happen under current law. But if the federal tax law changes so that the increase in capital gains rate is delayed for a year or 2 years, that would take money, that would have the effect of taking that $200 million out of the fiscal year 10, fiscal year 11 biennium and pushing it into fiscal 12, fiscal 13. So there's a problem there in terms of when this additional capital gains revenue might be recognized, especially if there's a change in federal tax law. That's the technical part of the story. The rest of the story really is changes in the outlook for revenues that are caused by a noticeably weaker economy than was forecast in November. It's pretty clear to everyone now that we're in a recession, and in fact, the real question is, are we going into a depression? There isn't a technical definition of a depression. You know, different people have different definitions of it. But just to make sure that everybody understands the difference between what we're in now and what occurred in the 1930s, Global Insight expects that real GDP in 2009 will decline by 2.7%. In the 1930s, real GDP between 1929 and 1932 fell by 25%. So this is not the same kind of a change as we're talking about there. Global Insight expects that the unemployment rate will reach 9.4% nationally, and we would expect that it'd be similar in Minnesota. For most of 2010, by 1932, the U.S. unemployment rate was 25%. And so, you know, you can see that this is a recession. It's likely to be the longest and the most severe recession in the post-war period, but it pales in impact beside the impact of the Great Recession. That said, this is not going to be a pleasant time. The first question everybody has is, how long is this recession going to last? In the February baseline scenario, Global Insight has the recession coming to an end later this summer. The third quarter has virtually no economic growth in it at all, And then at the fourth quarter of 2009, we actually start to grow in terms of economic output. In terms of employment, the number of jobs that are added doesn't start to be, the payroll employment doesn't start to pick up until 2010. It's a lagging indicator in this situation. But Global Insight is thinking that this will, at this point in February, Global Insight was thinking that the economy would start to turn around by summer. This is such a fluid situation, though, that, of course, we're waiting to hear what they have to say in their forecast that we'll get next week. And they could be noticeably different again as they were between November and December. One of the concerns that we have, or maybe an early indicator of where economists' thinking is going, is that in the last week or so, Fed Chairman Bernanke, when he's talking to Congress and to other groups, has said that if everything goes well, he thinks the economy will begin to turn up by the end of the year. Now, he's not saying by the end of the summer, he's saying by the end of the year, which indicates that he's more comfortable with a slightly longer estimate of how long it takes before the economy begins to pick up. Question that we also get is, how bad is the economy going to be? How bad is it? As I told you before, Global Insight's forecast now is for 2.7% decline in real GDP or inflation-adjusted GDP. To make sure that you understand how serious this is, let me put this a different way. Because of the decline in real output and the very slow rate of inflation, what this really means is that for over the period of the entire year of 2009, cash receipts, the collections, the receipts that come across the table and go into the cash register, for all the companies in the U.S. and all the businesses in the U.S. will be less than they were in 2008. It's not that profits aren't going to be as high, and it's not going to be that the rate of profit growth or the rate of receipt growth is slower. It's that they're actually going to be lower in 2009 than in 2008. So that's the situation we're in. Of course, if you have lower receipts, it's highly likely that you're going to have lower profits. It's highly likely that you're going to have lower employment costs because you aren't going to be able to afford to have the same number of people working. That's what's the talk is. The recovery is expected to begin in late 2009, but it's not supposed to be a rapid snapback. We're not expecting something that comes roaring back because there's a lot of built-up, pent-up demand in the system in there. It's not until 2012 that U.S. employment gets back to the level that it was at the start of the recession. Over the recession, we expect nationally to lose about 6 million jobs. About a little bit more than 3 million of those jobs were lost through the month of January. Tomorrow, you're going to find out how many jobs were lost in the month of February, and it's not going to be pretty. Turning to the top of page 6, Minnesota is not going to escape this recession. In fact, the recession has been a little bit more severe in Minnesota than it has been nationally already, and we don't think that that situation is going to change. From the peak of employment to the bottom of employment, we expect Minnesota will lose about 120,000 jobs over this period. To put this in perspective, normally Minnesota adds about 40,000 jobs a year. So what we're talking about is wiping out 3 years of job gains over the next 9 to 12 months or so. It's not that the federal stimulus package is going to be ineffective. In fact, we think the federal stimulus package is going to be effective. It may not be as effective as the White House estimates, but our forecaster, Global Insight, Macroeconomic Advisors, which is a competing forecast, Moody'sEconomy.com, Mark Zandi, which is a competing forecast, all of them agree that this forecast will add somewhere, or the stimulus package will add somewhere on the order of 2.25 to 2.5 million jobs that would otherwise have been lost without the stimulus package. So nationally, instead of losing the 6 million jobs, we would have lost 8 million jobs. For Minnesota, when you bring that down, it means that we would have lost another 45,000 jobs, or another, we would have gone from 120,000 jobs lost to 165,000 jobs lost, gone from 3 years worth of growth lost to 4 years worth of growth lost. The construction industry is an example. In our forecast, we have the construction industry losing 15,000 jobs. In the absence of the stimulus package and the action that's coming about in the stimulus package, we would have had 22,500 jobs. So cuts the job loss by about a third in the construction industry. In general, the situation is just not very good on the employment side in Minnesota, and the outlook isn't particularly good. Up to the end of December, we had lost 50,000 jobs. We had 70,000 jobs in the forecast, 70,000 more jobs to be lost in the forecast, 35,000 jobs lost in the first quarter, the quarter that we're in, January, February, and March. After we had done the forecast, Deed released the January estimates of what had happened to jobs in Minnesota, and we had lost 20,000 of those 35,000 jobs that were in the forecast in the month of January alone. So you can see that that this situation is really serious in there. The bottom of page 6 has a graph that may look a little familiar, although it's a different graph. What it says is the recession could be worse than forecast. This is a similar graph to what we showed you in December when we met. The difference is that the high line, the dashed line, is the November baseline forecast. The solid line is the February baseline forecast, and the line with the squares on it is the pessimistic forecast for February. November's pessimistic forecast, which was cleverly titled Meltdown, turned out to be too optimistic compared to what the forecast was actually. In November, the meltdown scenario had 2.4% decline in real GDP in 2009. The baseline forecast now has 2.7% decline in 2009, so it's actually worse. If you look at the forecast, the pessimistic scenario forecast, what you see is that what defines it is that the recession goes on a little longer than in the baseline scenario, that there are two additional quarters of decline. The economy doesn't decline a lot. It's not a steep decline, but it just doesn't start to recover until the first of 2010. And because it doesn't start to recover until the first of 2010, we start from a noticeably lower base. The recovery has declined. And under that scenario, there would be a material loss in revenues. Now, again, back to what I was telling you earlier about when's the recession going to end and what are people saying, there's strong indication that individuals, that economists and the chairman of the Federal Reserve think that this may be a little bit optimistic in terms of what's going on here. Part of the reason why it may be a little bit optimistic is even though stimulus package is going to work, it may take a little longer to get going than was in the forecast. There are two things. One is Global Insight and most other forecasters had a had more stimulus in the forecast, in their forecast, than actually was in was eventually passed by the House and Senate. In particular, Global Insight does not consider the $70 billion of alternative minimum tax relief that was included as part of the stimulus package to be anything unusual. They had already put that into their baseline forecast as something that would have been fixed anyway, and so there was $70 billion less there. And I think people are, in general, a little surprised at how long it takes to roll out, even for shovel-ready projects or quote-mark shovel-ready projects, how long it takes to roll the money out. And the CBO's estimates of how much money is going to be spent when is a little bit more pessimistic or a little bit slower than the economists had factored into their models. And so given that we now have better information, it wouldn't be a surprise to see this turn up in the economy pushed back a quarter or two quarters in there. Final thing I want to talk with you just a little bit about is what you should be looking at to see if the economy is on track, if the economy is turning up as we hope it will, and when it's turning up. And here, normally I would tell you to look at one number, and that's payroll employment. But payroll employment is not going to be a good concurrent indicator of how things are. It's going to lag a little bit. And it's also going to be very hard to interpret because what seems like bad news may actually be good news because it would be different from what we were thinking. I'll give you an example. If you read in the paper or hear on the news tomorrow that U.S. payroll employment fell by 400,000 jobs in the month of February, 400,000 jobs less than in January, that's good news. And the reason why it's good news is because the expectations are that we're going to lose between 600,000 and 700,000 jobs. So you have to not look at the absolute size of the number, but what you've got to look at is how is it doing compared to expectations, and if it's ratcheting down, if we're going from 600,000 down to 500,000 down to 400,000, that means we're moving in the right direction. If we're staying at 600,000 or going above that, obviously we're not. The real key to how quickly we're going to come out of this recession and whether we're on track or not is in something called the consumer spending numbers. These consumer spending numbers come out once a month as part of the personal income. And what we have to see is we have to see an increase in consumer spending. Consumer spending is 70% of GDP, and if that 70% doesn't start to grow, we're not going to come out of of the recession. Now, there are other things that have to occur as well. Credit markets have to improve. You know, we just have to just start doing things as well. But that consumer spending number is the key number. And at the same time the consumer spending number comes out, there is a savings rate number that comes out, which is just really the other side of the coin. You can either spend your money or save your money, and money spent is money not saved. Money saved is money not spent. So what we need to see is a stabilization of the consumer spending number. Right now it's gone, our savings number, it's gone up to 5% from the very low rates that we had before. Historically, if you look back over the last 40 or 50 years, the normal level, or the level that we've been at, was about 7%. And so if the consumer savings rate goes up to 6 or 7%, that means that there's going to be less in the way of consumer spending, and so it's going to delay the recovery. This is one of these situations where what makes sense for individuals and what's rational for individuals, in this case, rebuilding depleted savings, adding to your precautionary balances, rebuilding your retirement account, doesn't necessarily help the combined national economy, because it takes, in the short term, it takes spending out of the system. So that's one of the concerns. Finally, one of the things that we'll be watching, and I'm sure you'll be watching as well, is how revenues do compared to our forecast. We will have on April 10th an economic update that shows how withholding tax collections and sales tax collections have tracked the forecast since we've done the forecast here. In mid-May, we will have an estimate of final payments and refunds for tax year 2008 that will give us an idea as to how good our forecast was for capital gains realizations in tax year 2008. This is something where, again, there could be a several hundred million dollar swing, either favorable or unfavorable, that we won't know about until that time, because we have to forecast what's going on with capital gains in this very in the very uncertain year of 2008. That's why we're pleased that there's this $226 million balance for 2009, and we would encourage you not to use that for 2009 spending. I doubt if you would, but I want to be sure that you understand how important that is for us in order to avoid having a situation where we end up with a deficit right at the end of the 2009 biennium that we can't manage across into 2010. With that, I'd be glad to take any questions that anybody has, or if not, I can turn it over to the commissioner.
Mr. Chairman.
But Dr. Stinson, let me start out with a broad question. I hope I'm not misstating this, but first, relative to your last point, if there's been a temptation in the last X number of months to look at surplus monies, I can assure you that that won't be a problem. So don't worry about that one. But let me ask about this. When we look at the federal stimulus package, as I understand it, on the infrastructure part of it, that's to produce jobs and diminish unemployment and hopefully kickstart consumer spending. If more workers are employed, have more money, they'll be less hesitant to purchase whatever. The other part of the stimulus, as I understand it, not so much this particular stimulus, but the TARP payments to banks, lending institutions, and so on, is to kickstart lending so that you'll see housing starts, whatever. But are there a couple of things at play that negate that, and how does that factor into a forecast, if it does, if I'm correct in stating this, that the consumer confidence psychology is so bad that even with the infrastructure money and the reemployment of, let's say, you know, tens of thousands of people in the trades, that they're not going to spend money, and consumer spending will still remain fairly negative. And then the second part of that is relative to the TARP monies, that the institutions, and separate from the rhetoric which I share in terms of you know, conferences and bonuses and so on, but separate from that, which obviously is a much smaller part of it, but is the situation with the lending institutions, banks, et cetera, such that the TARP monies are being used to simply cover losses or undervalued assets, and the monies are not being used to kickstart lending because the institutions are in such trouble that they have to shore up internally before they can do anything externally. And if my suppositions are correct or even in the ballpark, how does that reflect on what might happen?
Mr. Chairman, you raise the fundamental questions. And the fundamental questions are, what is going to change consumer behavior, and what is going to change lending behavior? Let me start out and talk about consumer behavior. What we know is that consumer spending depends upon income, it depends upon wealth, it depends upon confidence, how good we feel about things, depends upon the level of debt to net worth that we have. Stimulus package is going to add to incomes in the way that you describe. It's going to add to the incomes for construction workers that are laid off. It's going to stop declines in income that would be caused by further layoffs of construction workers or retail workers or whatever. And so in that way, that adds to the forecast. That provides a stimulus for increased spending. However, there are some countervailing issues here. One of the things that's happened is that the 92.4% of the workforce that is not unemployed is insecure. They wonder if they're going to have their jobs, and they have increased their precautionary savings balances to keep money set aside in case they do get laid off. And so until there's a feeling among that group that the crisis is over, it's unlikely that the biggest part of society is going to increase their savings very much. Now, there's a second problem here, and the second problem is this wealth effect. And the wealth effect is turns out to be not a very big number when you think about it in terms of the proportional impact on your saving, on your spending activity, but it turns out to be a big number when you think about it in terms of aggregates. The loss in household net worth between the fourth quarter of 2007 and the start of 2009 is $13 trillion. That's a combination of loss in housing values and loss in equities and securities, $13 trillion. It's generally accepted that the wealth effect is that if you make an additional dollar or an additional $100 in the stock market or lose $100 in the stock market, it affects your spending by about $5 or about 5 cents on the dollar in changes in wealth. If you do the simple arithmetic, $13 trillion times 5 cents on the dollar is $650 billion of lost consumption due to the wealth effect. That gives you some idea of the reason for why we have to have such huge numbers in terms of of stimulus packages, that that's what's going to be lost. Now, there's a second issue that Tom Gillespie, the state demographer, and I have been concerned about actually for more than a little while, and that is the effect of aging on consumption patterns. And if you go back and think about where this loss in wealth has been concentrated, it's been concentrated in people 45 and older, people who have substantial savings for retirement that has been cut back substantially again. And the real question is whether you can expect people that are 45 or 50 or 55 to begin to consume at the normal rate, or whether they're not going to try and rebuild their savings accounts, their retirement accounts, over the next year or 2 years. And there's eventually going to have to be some resetting of expectations as to, you know, how well off you're going to be when you're retired, and that will then lead to more normal growth in spending. But it's not unreasonable to think, given the peculiar nature of the demographics that accompany this big loss in household wealth, that consumer spending is not going to recover as quickly as it has in the past. So that's the concern. We've got all of these things, lower income, lower wealth, diminished consumer confidence, higher debt-to-net worth ratios, all of which are pushing down consumption for logical reasons. And some of the, you know, we have to start turning them around in there. We can turn around the income a little bit by the stimulus package. It may be that the combination of the stimulus package and will bring about a little bit of general optimism to the country, although at this point I haven't seen it. But consumer confidence is so low, is lower than it's ever been in the history of the series. There's room for it to start turning up, obviously, in there. But that's the concern. That's the real issue. Now, going on to your question about lending, there are really two issues here. And the first is, even if financial institutions were healthy, it's very hard to stimulate the economy when the economy is in recession by lower interest rates, because you have to have people who want to borrow money. Why would a business, aside from borrowing money for replacing equipment, but why would a business be thinking about expanding at this point in the economic cycle? You'd wait until you could see the turn up in the economic cycle before you went out and borrowed to buy new equipment to build a new building or whatever. So even under the best of circumstances, this is not a powerful tool. Monetary policy is not a powerful tool for stimulating the economy. And in these circumstances, the situation is a lot worse. And the reason why the situation is a lot worse is not totally the fault of the financial institutions at this time. There is so much concern about the quality of credit, of the quality of loans, that if you issue a loan and you make a loan to somebody for $100,000 or $1 million or something like that, typically you wouldn't hold that on your books. Typically you would securitize that in some way and sell that so that you have more money to loan again. Otherwise, you don't have any money left to loan. And
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
Can Dr. Simpson finish?
Yeah, let me just finish this one little bit. And this issue of how much you can sell it for, you can't sell it for what you loaned it for, and so nobody trusts you that the quality of the loan is good. So I've heard bankers say, why should I make a loan for $100,000 when the market, when as soon as I book that loan, the market value of that loan is $60,000 or $50,000. And so that's the concern. Until we get the credit markets kind of straightened around so that we have some rational pricing for what these values of these loans are and these credits are, it's just going to be very difficult to do that.
So just to follow up then, is the TARP money is not being used for lending purposes. Is it being used then simply to shore up the institutions, as I asked?
The TARP money, the original concept of the TARP money was not to was not what it's been used for. The original concept of the TARP money was to provide price information financial institutions. The idea was that the federal government would go in and say that they would buy a certain class of credits, and they would buy them based on a reverse auction procedure. And with that reverse auction, that would give everybody the idea as to what the price that for this was, and so you could have trading go on, you'd have price discovery go on. What happened apparently was that Secretary Paulson found that two things. One is that the price that would be discovered would be so low that it would make institutions insolvent. The original concept was it would help liquefy credit. Instead, it found that it would make institutions insolvent. And he also found that institutions already were technically insolvent, and so they had to take that money and dump it in to just make them solvent to keep them from being from failing. Now, where we are now, you know, things have gotten a lot more complicated, and we'll see, I guess, what happens.
Yeah. Senator Foley.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. The doctor, what I am looking for is something simple, and hope that that you wouldn't look down too much on me. But what I'm concerned is that, on one hand, we're looking at stopping travel and salary freezes and other kinds of things where we save money, and then at the same time, we're looking at taking and encouraging spending and do things that would produce the money that's being sent out is to encourage people to buy cars and houses and all that sort of thing. How can you have one side doing that and then on the other side going right the opposite?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, there are you raise a challenging question, okay, and let me see if I can define some of the differences here. State government can't run a deficit. I mean, we can bond for capital projects, but we can't run an operating deficit by Constitution. So we have to make hard decisions between expenditures and revenues and the kind of decisions that you're talking about, cutting travel and things like that. The federal government has a responsibility not just to provide services, but also to manage the economy. And the federal government can run a deficit, and that deficit in times when the economy is very weak can provide some stimulus to the economy. Now, you can provide that stimulus in all kinds of ways. You can provide it by giving Medicaid reimbursement. You can provide it by providing direct aid to the auto industry. You can provide it by housing credits or things like that. Those are all choices that federal policymakers get to make. But the underlying question of should you run a deficit or not in a time of in a recession, the answer to that really is the improvement in the economy that is going to come about because of you running the deficit worth it in terms of the longer-term cost and in terms of higher interest rates and higher debt service in there. And that's something that the President and the Congress have to make a decision on. But then within it, you can make decisions about how do you provide that stimulus. And the President's stimulus plan has been designed to provide a whole menu of alternatives in terms of we're going to do a little bit for this, we're going to do a little bit for that, we're going to do a little bit for something else. And part of the reason why that is so spread out like that or so diffuse is that while we have models, statistical models, mathematical models that tell us what will happen, we don't know what's going to happen. We're off the charts in terms of, and so we're kind of hedging our bets across a wide set of activities in there. But this is a serious problem, and it's not easy to explain.
Mr. Chairman, one last question. Looking at that and looking at the volatility of the all of the phases of money and money management and so forth, aren't we likely to have a need to establish a significant amount of rainy day type of fund so that we have kind of a level use that the state expenditures and still be prepared if the economy really doesn't respond and we end up with some serious problems there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, one of my staff, Matt Shepner, and I did some work starting about this time last year to look at the volatility of state revenues. And what we found was if you want to protect yourself against a noticeable deficit 19 out of 20 times, at a five, so one time out of 20, you're still going to have this noticeable deficit, but 19 out of 20 times, the reserve that we would need would be somewhere around $1.5 billion compared to the $655 million that we had going into this recession. So we have some estimates now. I think everybody knew that $655 million wasn't going to protect us against a big recession, or even an ordinary recession. It was just going to make things a little less serious. In a big recession like we're in, it's clearly not adequate.
But you're, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stinson, you are looking at moving in that direction so that July 1st we're not going to have the roof fall in, so to speak.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, I'm not making decisions. You're the ones that are making decisions. We're just telling you some parameters for your thinking so that you can make the decisions.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stinson, for years we've been told by economists that we spend too much, we borrow too much, and we save too little. And to the point where we're a country now that buys more than we produce. Now you're basically saying we should be spending more. What's wrong with this picture? Long term, what's the best thing for our economy? Maybe I understand that short term we need consumer confidence back, and there certainly is a reasonable level of spending that people need to do to support themselves. But are there some long term things that we need to be thinking about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, the point that you bring up is something that's called the paradox of thrift that economists have talked about for years and years and years, and it's really the conflict between short-term and long-term. Certainly for longer-term, we needed to be saving more in the past, and we need to be saving more in the future because those longer-term decisions, the savings decisions, provide the investment capital that's necessary for people to borrow that are going to add to the productivity of the economy and make us better off 10 years and 20 years in the future than we are now. In the short term, however, it works directly against the health of the economy by increasing savings. And there's a natural tendency to increase savings in times of uncertainty. If you go back and look at what happened to the savings rate kind of stayed along like this, and then it goes down like this, except there's a spike up in 1991, and then it goes back down, and then it goes back down, and it goes down a lot more. What's the spike in 1991? Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait. It was like ringing a bell that, wait, the world's not quite as secure as we thought it was. People's savings rates increased enormously just for precautionary reasons. Then the war was over. We were successful, and people were reassured, and so we went back to spending.
Was there a little recession during that savings rate growth year? There was?
Yeah, the 1990-91 recession. So, you know, this isn't unusual. Here, what's unusual, I think, is just the play out against demographics, because so many people have lost so much in the way of their retirement savings accounts that we expect that savings rate is not going to blip back down but stay up a little bit longer, and that's going to cause us to have a little bit more extended recessionary period. Again, it's very unusual. The forecast that we have for employment growth is very unusual. If you look at what happened after recessions in the past, 5 years after recessions in the past, we had 2%, the weakest was 2% growth, but we had, you know, 8, 10, 12% growth on employment. Here, we're just going to be back to where we were at the start of the recession. Even in the twin recessions of the 1980s, where we had a recession in 1980, then we had a couple of quarters of growth, and then we had a more severe recession. When you look at those two together, by the end, after 5 years, we had more than 2% job growth compared to where we started before the first of those recessions. And now we'll only have, we'll just be flat.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question. Dr. Stinson, why do you think that the recession is worse in Minnesota than other places in the country?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, the key factor most people think in terms of how the economy's doing is job growth or what's happened to jobs. Between 1996, well, Minnesota now has fewer jobs than it did at the start of the 2001 recession. So
I understand that, but my question is why?
Oh, okay. And while the U.S. has grown over that period, okay, why? There are probably a couple of reasons. One is just some unusual things that went on. The housing industry was hit more severely in Minnesota, and because we have a heavier weight in the lumber and wood products and building materials area than the rest of the country, on average, that would hurt us a little bit more. Second, we had problems with a major air carrier, bankruptcy, takeover, strikes, things like that, and so that's hurt us a little bit more than we had. Third, there have been some special actions, Ford plant, for example, that's been shut down, halfway shut down, or more than halfway shut down in there. But that's not enough to explain all of it. The rest of it is probably a shift in production, national production of goods, toward defense and away from domestic consumer activities. Minnesota doesn't benefit to the same extent as the coastal states do from defense purchases. And so that's probably hurt us compared to our national counterparts as well.
Senator Ferguson.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stinson, in the forecast, it states that the ARRA provides $334 billion in tax relief. Do we know how much of that is expected to benefit Minnesota taxpayers?
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, we don't know exactly how much of that will benefit Minnesota taxpayers. Kind of a simple rule of thumb would be a little bit less than 2%. And so a little bit less than 2% would be, say, $6 billion or something like that.
Chairman, Dr. Stinson, is that spread out over 2 years? Or what?
Yes.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stinson, given this abysmal job report, it would seem to me that we would, one of our number one charges as a legislature would try to create jobs this session and put people back to work. And so as we're going through our budget deliberations and considering cutting budgets, inherent in cutting budgets is laying people off and adding to the problem of a jobless economy. Are there any indications of the effect of raising revenues and keeping people working as opposed to cutting budgets and laying people off? Are we better off keeping these people working, or are we better off laying these people off as a result of our budget decisions? In other words, should we raise revenues and keep people working, or should we cut the budgets and lay people off?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomassoni, you know, that's a real hard question to deal with, because it's going to take money out of the economy whether you raise taxes or whether you lay people off. The difference in terms of economic stimulus comes about is that we believe that if you raise taxes by $10, if I raise your taxes by $10, that you won't cut your consumption by the full $10, that you will cut your consumption by $10 minus some amount that won't go into savings in there. Whereas if I cut your income, it's going to be full. It's going to have a full impact on consumption, and so that's the economics. The economics would say that in terms of the impact on economic activity, that you would have a smaller impact by cutting jobs than by raising taxes.
A greater negative impact.
Yeah.
Dr. Stinson, let me follow up on Senator Pappas' question. It's with maybe more of a geopolitical twist to it, relative to China. Is our symbiotic relationship with China such that they have no choice but to purchase our debt because we're the only major market they have, or at some point do they pull out, and what happens then?
Mr. Chairman, there's obviously a lot of concern about the U.S. relationship with China. If, as you're indicating, they were to pull out and not purchase our debt or to scale back our debt, in order to sell that debt, it would cause us to have to raise our interest rates. If we raise our interest rates, then that raises interest rates that are available for ordinary people to borrow as well. And so that cuts back investment, and that cuts back economic growth. The problem that the Chinese have is that they own so much of our debt that as you know, there's an inverse relationship between the value of a credit, a bond, and the interest rate. When the interest rate goes up, the value of the bond goes down. When the interest rate goes down, the value of the bond goes up. Okay. The Chinese own so much of our debt that any indication that U.S. interest rates were going to go up would reduce the value of their holdings. And so they really can't, without taking a big hit, do anything drastic with respect to their holdings of our credit. They can't provide inklings that they're going to start getting out of U.S. Held credits or anything like that, because everybody would know that, wait a minute, if that occurs, interest rates are going to go up, the value of my bonds are going to go down, so I'm going to get out of U.S. bonds, and it'd be a huge crowd rushing to get out a very small door, and there'd be a lot of damage in the world financial system in the melee of trying to get out first. And the Chinese know that, and so they're very likely over time to reduce their dependence upon U.S. credits, but they're not going to do anything abrupt or anything like that.
So what we should hope for is that President Obama works hard on the Mideast and other parts of the world, but he really needs to become really good friends with the Chinese leadership.
Mr. Chairman, if you the nightmare scenario is a diplomatic breakdown of some sort, that would be the only reason why you would have this. And so it's very important to be very good friends with the Chinese.
So we're probably done talking to the Chinese about human rights violations. They can torture whoever they want at this point.
The value of their currency. Mr. Geithner's comment was probably not appropriate.
The question is that one of the things, and this kind of follows up with something that Sarah Foley mentioned, but one of the discussions, not so much here at this point, although who knows as to how we proceed in terms of public employees, but certainly you read of and hear of companies, instead of laying off people, are they looking at some kind of extended furlough or a Friday furlough or something? How does that factor into an economic forecast in terms of employment and payroll?
They have time to go shopping then.
Well, I guess that answers the question.
Help stimulate the economy.
Mr. Chairman.
Or is that just too anecdotal to make any difference?
It's too much detail that... I was asked yesterday at the House Ways and Means Committee, how are the tax cuts factored into the forecast in there? Does it take into account the difference between the high income tax increases and the low income? And the answer is no. The models, have thousands of equations, but there isn't an equation for the kind of thing that you're talking about. It's much more aggregate than that.
Okay, so I should stick to questions about the Chinese then. One of the things about your presentation this morning, unlike the briefing on Tuesday, is you mentioned that in promulgation of this forecast, you did not have the time to take into account the GDP report from Friday with that collapse to 6.2%, whatever it was. And you offered a little bit of insight into that on Tuesday, but is it possible to further elaborate as to how that type of, a couple things. One, how the actual GDP downturn impacts where we might be. And second, although I guess maybe you've answered the question, that what guarantee is there that this doesn't continue to happen, that GDP growth continues to contract at a basis larger than expected, even under the pessimistic scenario?
Mr. Chairman, part of your question, as you know, we rely a lot on Global Insight, and Global Insight will have a forecast out the middle of next week that will take into account the revisions to GDP that were announced last Thursday. And so, we can speculate on how they're trying to forecast their forecast, but their forecast really will depend significantly on the news that comes out tomorrow, which is the payroll employment for February. And, you know, if you can tell me how much jobs are going to be down in February, first of all, you and I together could make a lot of money in the market betting on it probably.
Well, I offered you Mr. Mossman earlier with, you know, his predictions,
But anyway, we'll share the March forecast with you and Mr. Mossman, and so that you can see how it is. We can imagine a situation where the bad news for the fourth quarter is just pushing ahead of the weakness in the economy, and the economy is going to recover more rapidly. Or you can imagine a situation where you look at it and you say, the economy was worse than we thought in November or in early February for the fourth quarter, and it's not going to get any better. It's just going to go off that lower base. And until Global Insight does something, I don't want to speculate.
Senator Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for Mr. Hansen. In the governor's budget, what did you have in there for fee increases?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I think it was $2 million in the general fund and about $30 million in other funds, roughly.
Other questions from the committee? Dr. Stinson, I could come up with 1,000 questions for you, particularly under these circumstances. This is not maybe a question as such, maybe more of a discussion point. But I was at a meeting yesterday morning, and one of the people there was the head of one of the major investment offices in the state. And he made the comment that a couple times a year he'll get together with CEOs in town, and he describes the group as a collection of major CEOs and then, you know, some mid-sized CEOs. But he had a dinner last week, and said that there was a consensus that there was disagreement as to the impact of, you know, the federal stimulus package was a good idea, bad idea, but and other issues. But there was a consensus that the economy is entering into an era of what he called resetting, that every one of them agreed to that, and that the comments around the table were that they've kept on redoing budgets. You know, every 3 months, 4 months, they redo a budget, and things get worse. And their consensus was we should just do everything in one fell swoop, just downsize what we do, whether it's big or small, do it all at once, and then assume that's it, and that we are now into a new economy, and that we're not downsizing with the expectation that we will be upsizing in a year or 2 years. And he said it was listening to that was very sobering for all of them, and for the group of us, it was pretty sobering listening to that. So that's not in the form of a question, but are we getting into an era where 5 years from now, I assume we're not going to go back to a barter system, but we're entering an economy that nobody knows, and I guess the question would be, what shape would that economy take?
Mr. Chairman, it's a very interesting question. One of the things that you learn in introductory microeconomics is that businesses will continue to operate as long as they can cover the variable cost of production and pay a little bit on their fixed costs in the short term. But in the long term, of course, if you can't cover both your variable cost and your fixed cost, you're out of business because you're going to lose money. And we don't ever, when we're teaching about this, we don't ever talk about when do you go from the short term to the long term, and what your business executives were saying really is that they're agreed that they're going to a long-term solution rather than a short-term solution, that's the way they're thinking. And of course that means huge changes in the structure of the economy in there. So it's just raised a very interesting question as to what's going to go on. It's certainly not optimistic for the short term in terms of economic activity, because there are a lot of dislocations that occur when you go from short term to long term thinking from a business point of view, and of course there would be from the state's point of view too.
Thanks. Other questions for Dr. Stinson or Commissioner or Mr. Showalter? I appreciate your being here. I have to admit, I think this is what, my seventh year as finance chairman, I think. And obviously I've served on this committee for a number of years, and so I've had the chance to listen to you at least a couple of times a session for quite a while. And it's striking in listening to this time just how absolutely dead quiet everybody is. It's a pretty striking time. And so appreciate your insights. Obviously when things are going well, but that much more when things are not going so well. So other questions, comments? All right. Well, thank you very much, and appreciate the presentation on the part of all three of you.
To the next.